EEOC against Watkins Motor Lines. Ms. Coleman.
May it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether the District Court erred in treating Jackson's charge as withdrawn despite the EEOC's refusal to consent to withdrawal. The EEOC contends that this refusal, which occurred in the course of an ongoing agency investigation, is an unreviewable agency decision. Watkins appears to rely on the Administrative Procedures Act to authorize review of the agency's refusal to consent to withdrawal. However, the APA requires final agency action in order to make agency action reviewable. Final agency action is something with determinate legal consequences for someone. In this case, the EEOC's refusal to consent to withdrawal had no determinate legal consequences for anyone. Watkins argues that the EEOC's refusal to consent to withdrawal stymied Jackson's ability to settle his claim with Watkins. If that's true, that is a factual decision that Watkins made. That is not a necessary result from the EEOC's refusal to consent to withdrawal. Jackson and Watkins may still settle on their own, and indeed, if the EEOC pursues its investigation and finds cause to believe that Jackson is entitled to relief, then the EEOC may choose to pursue relief on Jackson's behalf, perhaps even facilitating a settlement down the road. If this Court holds that the EEOC's refusal to consent to withdrawal is reviewable, this will open the doors to a flood of litigation on the EEOC's charge processing decisions. It is especially notable that this case is arising in the context of a subpoena enforcement proceeding. As this Court has clearly noted in United Airlines, a subpoena enforcement proceeding has an extremely limited scope of review. All that the Court is supposed to look at when determining if there is a valid charge is if the charge is in writing, if it's under oath, and if it presents a clear statement of the facts alleging a basis for the discrimination alleged.
Doesn't the EEOC have a better case somewhere in the nation to pursue than this one? This company is out of business.
Whether or not we do, the Supreme Court has said that Title VII clearly leaves it to the EEOC and not to the courts to determine the public interest. The EEOC is charged with evaluating the public interest, which of course includes the interest of the charging parties, but may be somewhat different and somewhat broader. In this case, the early investigation that the EEOC was able to perform reveals that there were at least three other individuals who may have been discriminated against based on the same policy that Jackson is challenging in his charge. If the EEOC is permitted to continue its investigation, it may discover more possible victims. This Court made clear in Harvey Wallner that if the EEOC agrees to permit withdrawal of a charge, it can forfeit its jurisdiction over an investigation and any potential subsequent lawsuit. Accordingly, given the fact that there were other potential victims.
Are you saying if you drop this lawsuit and you had a similar situation arise some other place, you'd be a stop from proceeding?
I'm not saying that, but I am saying
that's what you just said.
No. There are three additional people that we know about. There may be more people who are discriminated against by Watkins, even assuming that the EEOC goes on to find that the challenge policy is illegal, which is not a given at this point. If we find other people down the road in the future who are discriminated against in the past, a later filed commissioner's charge may not be able to reach the same scope of relief that this charge filed by Jackson years ago would reach. Watkins is trying to use its private settlement offer with Jackson to force the government to halt its investigation. At this point, the investigation has dragged out for 4 years. The subpoena was first issued 4 years ago. The EEOC respectfully urges this Court to reverse with directions to enforce the subpoena. Thank you.
Please, the Court. This case is about the unremarkable but bedrock principle of administrative law that the actions of an administrative agency are subject to judicial review except where Congress has clearly and unequivocally exempted such actions from the review process. And here, it is particularly important that the decision at issue be subject to judicial review and oversight because it goes to the agency's inherent authority to act under its enabling statute.
What response do you have to the agency's reliance on FTC against Standard Oil? Standard Oil made the identical argument that you're making, that the agency lacked authority to continue its investigation. And the Supreme Court held that that could be reviewed only when the agency's investigation was over.
This is not about the scope of the agency's investigation. It's about the on-off switch that a charge
That's serves. The argument Standard Oil made. That's why I'm asking you to discuss that case. The agency relies on it in their brief. I notice your brief didn't even cite it. This is your opportunity.
To distinguish, Your Honor, we think there are two reasons why this is subject to judicial review.
I'm asking you to discuss the bearing of Standard Oil.
We don't think that Standard Oil is controlling. We don't think that Standard Oil involved a request to withdraw a charge. And that is the issue here.
That's like saying Standard Oil was decided on Tuesday. Standard Oil establishes a legal principle that whether the agency is authorized to continue an investigation cannot be reviewed until the investigation's end and the entry of a final order. Now, is there some distinction saying that this, saying you've made a different challenge is like saying this is the EEOC and that was the FTC?
Yes, I think that it's fundamentally a different challenge. The EEOC is not the FTC. It does not have plenary authority investigate.
That's exactly the problem. The claim about the agency's source of authority had nothing to do with the Supreme Court's holding. The Supreme Court thought it was making a holding about a fundamental principle of administrative law. Now, you may have some ground to distinguish it. I was saying, you know, that's the FTC, this is the EEOC, as a frivolous line of distinction. It's not one you want to embrace.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe it is a frivolous line of distinction. I think that the EEOC and Title VII has a special statutory scheme.
The kind of line of distinction that would get us reversed summarily by the Supreme Court. If we said FTC against Standard Oil applies only to the FTC, it would take two lines to reverse us summarily.
Your Honor, the position that Watkins is taking is not that the FTC v. Standard Oil applies only to the FTC, but that Title VII is a unique statute. It is a unique statute.
Every statute is unique. That's what everybody says about every statute, and it's true. The language of Title VII is different from the language of every other statute, or it wouldn't exist. Where does that get us?
It is a statutory scheme that has been set up that is unique and different from most of the statutory schemes in which an investigation by an agency is authorized. In this case, the agency can only proceed when it has a valid charge. And that is part of the inherent purpose that underlies the statute.
The FTC can proceed only when there is a valid complaint. That's part of the FTC's scheme. The argument in Standard Oil was that there was no valid complaint. Indeed, the argument in Standard Oil was stronger than that. It was that there was a provision of law in the FTC Act specifically forbidding the FTC to investigate the oil industry at all, ever. And the Supreme Court said that could not be reviewed until the FTC's case was over.
The Title VII scheme was set up for a different purpose. When Title VII was created, it was for the purpose of encouraging the voluntary compliance with the statute. There was no enforcement authority whatsoever in the statute. And the charging party had complete control over the process. The statute does not give the agency the ability to have veto power over the removal of the complaint.
Well,
that's different
You're not dealing with the finality issue, but let's deal with this question, whether the charging party has control. My understanding of the statute is the agency can investigate on its own. Any commissioner can issue a charge at any time. So why don't we view the agency's refusal to allow a private party to withdraw his charge as identical to a commissioner's charge?
Because it is not a commissioner's charge. And, Your Honor, respectfully, I believe The agency has no authority to proceed on its own. It must have a charge, whether it's an individual charge of discrimination or a commissioner's charge, but there must be a charge.
If you would deal with my question, I'd appreciate it. Why aren't these two things functionally the same? When the agency says we're not allowing a private party to withdraw, that is functionally the same thing as saying we're proceeding on a commissioner's charge, that is, on our own.
Because there is no functional equivalent allowed by the statute
or
by the enabling regulations. The statute and regulations say there must be a charge, not the functional equivalent of a charge. If you allow for the functional equivalent of a charge...
Look, as you know, last year the Supreme Court held that a charge under Title VII is anything stating a grievance. It doesn't have to be on formal charge paper. That's genesis of the kind of question I'm asking.
But it nonetheless says that there is a charge, whether or not it is an a formal charge paper. It nonetheless is a charge.
I give up. But it's the Supreme Court expressly held there does not have to be a paper called charge. All there has to be is something functionally giving notice.
And there is nothing functionally giving notice here if Mr. Jackson's request to withdraw his charge had been granted. And the enabling statute does not give the agency the authority to veto a request to withdraw a charge. So when that request was made, it served to make that charge a nullity. There was no charge nor any functional equivalent of a charge that was outstanding, nor was there any effort made by the agency to go and seek a commissioner's charge, to identify additional purposes that would be served by continuing with their investigation. So whether or not a charge or a functional equivalent of a charge would support this investigation, here we had neither of those, Your Honor, absolutely neither of them. And I think it's important to recognize that the existence of a charge is jurisdictional. And so while the district court elected not to address...
Where did that idea come from, by the way?
From?
That there is anything about the district court's jurisdiction in the existence of a charge. There's a federal statute, it's 28 U.S.C. 1345, that says that any suit filed by the United States or any agency is within the district court's jurisdiction.
This is about a subpoena enforcement action and the agency's ability to enforce a subpoena. And an agency subpoena from the EEOC requires, as a jurisdictional prerequisite, that a valid charge exists.
Where in the United States Code is a district court's jurisdiction contingent on the validity of a charge? I just cited you one jurisdictional statute, and I assume you know that both Zipes against TWA and Arbaugh against Y&H expressly hold that substantive conditions in Title VII are not jurisdictional. So why would you think this is jurisdictional despite Zipes and Arbaugh? And, of course, that's not all of those similar cases.
The off-cited Shell Oil supports our position, and the district court so found, that in order to enforce a subpoena, an EEOC subpoena, there must be a valid underlying charge. And the court found properly, I believe, that that was a jurisdictional prerequisite for the district court. If this court is inclined not to find that to be a jurisdictional prerequisite.
Maybe I'm not sufficiently clear. There is a big difference in federal law between failure on the merits and lack of subject matter jurisdiction. I'm asking why you are saying that what you view as an EEOC failure on the merits equates to lack of subject matter jurisdiction in the district court.
I'm not arguing a failure on the merits, Your Honor. I'm arguing that there is no charge by operation of the enabling statute and the request to withdraw the charge that would support an EEO subpoena and allow the EEOC to continue its investigation. The jurisdictional nature of it is that the EEOC may not investigate
without
a charge.
Maybe I can ask the question one last time in a different way. Do you have any comment on the bearing on this of Zipes, which held that the lack of a valid charge is not a jurisdictional problem? That's the holding of Zipes.
The comment that I would offer on that is that we are here in the posture of an EEOC subpoena, and that in order for the EEOC to have an enforceable investigatory subpoena, there must be a valid underlying charge. That's what Shell Oil states, and that's what the district court appropriately found. If this court is not inclined to find that to be a requirement despite Shell Oil, then there were other jurisdictional grounds that were asserted below that the court did not decide because she did not need to decide them based upon her finding of a lack of jurisdiction for other reasons. Those include mootness and the lack of jurisdiction.
Counsel, I asked a particular question, which is if you could discuss the bearing of Zipes. Your answer, so far as I can tell, has nothing to do with Zipes. If you don't know the case, you can say so, but filibustering is not a good response.
Your Honor, my response is that I don't believe that Zipes controls this. I believe Shell Oil controls this because this is a subpoena enforcement action. And we're here to enforce an administrative subpoena. The administrative subpoena under the particular statutory scheme involved here, which is 29 U.S.C. 161, and the EEOC statutory provision that adopts 29 U.S.C. 161 imposes certain requirements. One of those is that there be a valid charge. There is no valid charge here because the charge was requested to be withdrawn, and the charging party has the inherent authority to withdraw a charge. The EEOC's veto of that was without any legal effect, and as a result, the charge did not exist, and there was no basis on which the EEOC could seek the enforcement of its subpoena. Moreover, this is one of those cases where what may appear to be an esoteric question of administrative law has real-world consequences. I think it's worth noting the underlying policy that the EEOC is seeking to enforce. And the courts have noted that the only legitimate reason for an EEOC investigation is to pursue an enforcement action. Here, the conduct that is the subject of a potential enforcement action is the good faith effort of an employer that was subjected or suffered three horrible incidents of workplace violence in the course of 5 years to try to make its employees safe.
Well, and that's why I asked originally the counsel for EEOC why they want to pursue a case like this, which looks very troubling on the merits for the EEOC. But I have a question. Who do you represent?
Watkins Motor
Lines. Watkins went out of business 2.5 years ago. It sold out to FedEx, right?
It continues to exist as a legal entity.
With assets?
No. Not to my knowledge. But it sold its assets, but it is a corporate entity, and it continues to have the authority to act, and that authority to act includes its ability to ask me to defend its interests in this lawsuit, partly because the Watkins family, and it was a family-owned company, feels very strongly that morally and with respect to their legal obligations to their former employees, that they were not going to allow themselves to be browbeaten into accepting violent criminals into their workplace under the particular circumstances that they had suffered, where they felt strongly that if there were any circumstance where there was a justifying business necessity that would authorize them not to bring violent criminals into the workplace, this would be it.
So if the EEOC consented to the withdrawal of the charge, who would pay Jackson?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I'm at liberty to disclose that. I believe it may be covered by attorney-client privilege.
Okay. So it's not. So Watkins doesn't exist anymore.
That's right.
As a legal entity.
There is a confidential settlement agreement.
With Jackson.
With Jackson, yes. That was entered into prior to the company going out of business.
Okay.
But I think, Your Honor, that your point is well taken as to whether or not there's a better case. The considerations that the EEOC raised in their own brief as to what might be looked at in deciding whether a charge should be withdrawn are both the strength of the defense and the operational status of the employer. The operational status of the employer obviously weighs against proceeding in this case, as does the strength of the defense. If there were ever a justifying business necessity, this would be it. And whether or not the court believes this is something subject to judicial review, the Leadham versus Kine, among other things, suggests that this may well be the circumstance where judicial review would be appropriate because otherwise it would not be subject to review, and it is an important issue. The EEOC is pursuing a policy that the statute and common sense suggests in this 9/11 world is not one that we should be imposing on employers to bring convicted violent criminals into a workplace that has suffered repeatedly from workplace violence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kenney. Anything further, Ms. Coleman?
Unless the court has questions, the EEOC waives rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.